This is Dr. Richard Barone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Dr. Ron Milam. Ron and I are again in Lubbock in the interview room at the Vietnam Archive. Today is September 7th, 2005. It's approximately 10 a.m. Central Standard Time. And Ron, since our last session, I've thought about some of the more general questions about, or more general issues of war, and also of the Vietnam War, and wanted to get your ideas on that. One of them is the enemy, the individuals and the armies you were facing there during your time as an advisor. Could you describe who and what your enemy was according to what you witnessed?
For most of my tour, up until the last 2 months, the first 10 months, you might say, of my tour, with only one exception that I can think of, we were fighting the Viet Cong. This was, of course, 1970 and 1971, and there's no question in my mind that I didn't know it at the time, but now that I'm, as a historian, and looking back, I can put it together that the Viet Cong infrastructure had basically been destroyed during Tet. We know that now. And so the Viet Cong that we fought were not of the regimental sizes or even the battalion sizes that we know existed. They were remnants of that. They were small units. They were they truly were the farmers by day and the VC by night. Mm-hmm. And so most of the enemy contact that we had were Viet Cong were being asked by their superiors to make their presence known in the Phung Nha district by terrorist actions. The most common one being blowing up civilians on the highway through landmines, okay, or through ambush, or periodically, once a week perhaps, mortaring our compound, both the American part of the compound and the district headquarters. And I can only assume that they were doing that because that made their presence known. In other words, we lived in a basically what we would report back to the superiors in Saigon and ultimately in the Pentagon, I guess, was a pacified district.
Right.
A successful pacification, a Vietnamization. Everything, that is, we could go almost anywhere we wanted all day long, but at night there weren't very many places you wanted to be other than in your own secure compound. And so they would mortar us at night. And there was also this responsibility that we had, along with the American Engineering Company down the road, to keep Highway 14 open, right, between Pleiku and Bami Thuy.
Right.
And so the enemy that we fought was basically the Viet Cong who were there and were in their were present, and along with the RFPF group and the PSDF in more of a defensive mode with their own villages. Mm-hmm. That's who we saw mostly.
Katie, let me interrupt just for a second. When you say you saw them, what do they look like?
The Viet Cong?
Yeah, what are they wearing?
Well, I will have to tell you that until towards the end of my tour, I seldom saw Viet Cong alive. That when we were ambushed along the highway, and that was mostly highway activity, unless we were successful in terms of killing one or capturing him, when that happened on a couple of occasions, most of the time they were gone. We didn't see anything but the remnants. So the few times that it happened, they were black pajama clad. There was a couple of times, however, where the Viet Cong that we killed were in loincloths,
Really?
Yes. Rare. Rare. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that issue about were there Montagnards who were Viet Cong, right. The answer is yes. But not, I didn't see that as frequently as I saw Vietnamese.
Okay. How were they, I guess, asking about the dead bodies, you know, you saw more frequently. How were they outfitted as far as weapons, any kind of headgear? What did they have?
AKs were pretty standard. We did have one situation where we where the individual was carrying an SKS, and I was able to I actually captured that and kept it in my hooch for my tour. Headbands. Black headband in the case that I'm particularly thinking of. No helmets or anything like that. Ho Chi Minh sandals, or what we would call Ho Chi Minh sandals, rubber sandals. Mm-hmm. Probably one of the things that I was always most curious about is the lack of provisions that they carried. The very small pouch of rice. Other than that, you know, kind of stereotypically, what we think of is pajama clad. The pajamas not being very nice, not being very clean, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Soldiers were young, usually. I mean, it would appear to me probably teenagers. And as far as combat effectiveness, I never really served in a protracted, long firefight with the Viet Cong. Because they were performing terrorist activities. They were hit and run.
And not necessarily on you or the folks that you were working with, but on civilians.
Yes. Well, we saw more of the remnants of their actions in that case. The few times that we were ambushed, and I say few times, it was, I think, as I told you the last time, my short-timer's calendar was marked with all of the combat activities, and I had little codes for them. And I think we probably were ambushed. Our own unit, that is my Jeep, was probably ambushed once a month, 10 to 12 times. It seems like almost every time I went to play coup, for whatever reason, we'd get ambushed. And it was partly our own fault, because we'd be kind of pushing the envelope a little bit on whether we on the times that we would come home. We'd stay a little bit later than we should have. So we always considered the road to be safe between about 8 and 5. 0800 and 1700 mm-hmm. was the safe time on the highway. Mm-hmm. If you got out before 0800, the engineers had not had time to clear the road and to do a minesweep. And they did that every day.
Right.
If you came after that time, there wasn't enough activity, enough traffic to make it secure. You were sort of by yourself, and you were setting yourself up. So most of the ambushes occurred after 5. I never went out before 0800, maybe once or twice. But mostly we always went out. We were coming home from play coups after 1700 hours. And that was not a safe situation. So we would get ambushed, and almost in most cases, depending on the size of our convoy, if we were running a single vehicle convoy, which was a mistake, or a single vehicle, we didn't do that very often, then we just kept going. If you got shot at, you didn't stop.
And when you say ambush, you mean it could come in the form of some shots.
But that's what it was. It was usually small. It was usually the first thing that would happen would be a B-40 or an RPG, a rocket-propelled grenade fired from a B-40 rocket launcher. And that would be the first thing.
Okay.
And if that hit the vehicle, then the follow-up would be small arms fire. A lot of times the B-40, thank goodness, would miss, and it would fly over our head, and you'd hear, you'd know what happened, and then small arms and fire would follow. If we were by ourselves, if, like I say, if it was just me and a driver and usually a gunner, we had a machine gun on the lawn, we had an M60 on each of our Jeeps and a 50 cal on one of them. And my Jeep, particular Jeep, had just an M60, and we had usually our interpreter would ride on the back and in the machine gun position, standing up.
Right.
And then I would ride shotgun, and then I had a driver. And when we'd run the roads that way, if we were by ourselves, then we would just keep going. And when we'd get back and we made it to the compound, we would report that we were ambushed. If we had at least three vehicles, and that happened frequently, whenever we made a beer run or a food run into Play Coup, or if we were out working in the villages, mm-hmm. and we had, a lot of times we would take medical people out with us. Bakshi, we would take our sometimes American AMA representatives would come in and do their doctor thing, and we would take them out. So we would, if that were the case, we would have three or four or maybe even five vehicles. Mm-hmm. So if that was the case and we got ambushed, then we would, as soon as we felt like we were out of the killing zone, if it was the shots are behind you, so to speak, we would pull over and we would pursue.
On foot?
On foot, yes. The confidence level was that we were being ambushed by a force smaller than us. And we would pursue and we would call in artillery. We pretty much had, we knew exactly where we were along the road, the highway, because we did
right.
it so often.
Right.
We would pursue, and we would call in airstrikes. We would call in our, what was almost organic artillery that we had back at the base. The
okay.
first of the 92nd Field Artillery were located south of us. Yeah, we knew. We'd just call them out. And so we could get artillery up in 5 minutes, no problem.
Would you call artillery before you chased on foot, or would you do it?
Usually the first thing that we would do when we got off the vehicle is, we were on the radio, 25s mounted on each Jeep, and we would immediately call artillery, and then we would pursue.
Okay. And how quick would their artillery respond? Was it
5 minutes? Oh yeah, because it was all preset locations.
Let me ask you this: how many casualties would you take if you didn't turn to fight, stop and fight, basically, or pursue? How often would you take casualties?
You mean our own?
Yes.
Yeah. I don't believe that. We had guys in the Jeeps get wounded from just shrapnel and stuff like that, but nobody was ever seriously wounded. But in other words, they were totally ineffective with their
right.
ambush.
Right.
And in all of my experience and in all of my people's experience, we never lost anybody on the highway. Now, I can't say that about the other units that the artillery guys and the engineers lost some people, and we would be part of that. We would mm-hmm. that happened on a couple of occasions. We were called in one particular case that I remember, and I may have told this story about the engineer unit that hit a landmine with a deuce and a half.
Yes.
Yeah, that was very. That was my first experience with an American casualty.
So the. Physically, they were usually ineffective.
Yes.
They're shot.
Yes.
How about mentally? Was there a purpose, do you think, to what they were doing? Is this to kind of harass you?
It was absolutely to harass us. It was absolutely, here come the Americans, I'm convinced. And let's let them know we're here. And so what that tells me is they were never, in our area, they never had an effective fighting force that was large enough to ever engage mm-hmm. us. It was just a matter of, it may have been units in this, 3 to 5 men kind of thing. It may have been very small.
But you didn't really know for sure.
No, and we didn't know for sure. We would usually find blood trails from the artillery, but we never really, I'm trying to think, two, maybe three occasions where we actually killed somebody. So the assumption I've always made is based on the times that we found VC was that it was always VC, that there was only one occasion, and this was in October of 1970, October 7th, as I recall, when I was out on patrol and we were ambushed by NVA. That was my first contact with NVA. And then there was virtually none after that until March.
Okay, let me stop and ask a couple questions about these ambushes, and I do want to come back to the NVA and compare the two.
Right.
But I'm wondering about the mentality that you all had. You wanted to go get food, you wanted to get beer, you wanted to take care of your personal business, you wanted to do what you wanted to do.
And sometimes we were called into meetings.
Okay.
Pleiku was the two core headquarters for MACV, so we would be somebody who called in.
What about the mentality you all have, like, okay, we're gonna go to Pleiku for whatever reason, and it's decided, and there's no hesitation, really, you're gonna go to get food, you're going to a meeting.
Right.
But knowing that most likely you're gonna be shot at. Most likely that RPG round is going to come in. Most likely you're going to have small arms fire, and one of you could very well, get hit with shrapnel for a case of beer, or going to the meeting. Mm-hmm. How did you deal with that mentally, or how did you see others?
Well, as silly and crazy as it sounds, nobody wanted to go to meetings, everybody wanted to go for beer.
Sure.
I don't ever remember thinking. Until the very end of my tour, the last month, I don't ever remember thinking that this will be the time. There is a confidence level that you start achieving after you've been shot at a few times. Mm-hmm. And after the RPG that I mentioned last time bouncing off the windshield, not exploding, you start thinking that you are really better than they are at what you do. Mm-hmm. I would compare it to any kind of civilian thing where life and death perhaps isn't involved. You get confident about your ability to do what it is you do, whether that be lead people in a profit-making venture, teach school, whatever it is, you get to where you think you're pretty good at it. Mm-hmm. And I think I felt that way. So I don't ever remember thinking, gee whiz, I shouldn't do this until the very end of my tour.
And that's because you were going home. I mean,
Exactly.
Okay.
So, it's just one of those things you did. The other thing that I've always thought is interesting, now that I read a lot about Vietnam, and more so than in the last 5 or 6 years than I ever did in my life, is I also don't ever remember thinking that because I was an officer, that somehow or other I was different than my NCOs or my enlisted guys. You know, we were such a small unit anyway, with two MAT teams and an advisory team, 15 total people, that everybody had to do these things. Mm-hmm. And so the only thing that I sort of did that maybe was pulling rank, if you will, mm-hmm. as far as those things are concerned, is I seldom drove. And that was more a function of, I think as I told you last week, I didn't even know how to drive a stick shift until I got into Vietnam. I'd never driven a stick shift. So it was more a function of not being good at that and not being real confident with my ability to drive than it was my fear. And riding shotgun, I just thought was a good position for me. So I didn't drive as much as most of the other people.
Was there a place in this road on Highway 14 where you would expect the shots to come from, or would it happen randomly anyway?
Well, it was somewhat random, but I can also remember that there were certain places that the incidents were higher, not just incidents of my own situation, but like I say, if I'm in my own memory now and some of the saying that we maybe in my own experiences we got ambushed once a month, say 10 to 12 times in my tour, mm-hmm. that's just me individually, there's 15 of us. I think every single person who served with me would say the same thing, and they weren't always with me,
right?
Which means that probably maybe almost every time we went out, we got ambushed. Somebody from the unit got ambushed. So we would mark each ambush on a map. So we knew exactly where these incidents were taking place. And to this day, I can remember where those places were, so much so that when I went back to Vietnam in 2001, we, of course, drove Highway 14 from Bam Mi Thuot to Pleiku. I pointed out to my wife all the places that were most highly, more likely to be ambushed than others.
How did you feel being back there?
It was just as weird as it could be. Yeah, but nothing had changed. I mean, nothing had changed. Well, by that I mean the mountain and the river and the bridge. All those things don't change because the war's over.
Right.
Now, you know, villages and come and go and people build and stuff like that. But as far as the road itself and the turns, where the turns in the road,
right.
I particularly remember exactly where one turn was. It seems like we got hit every time we turned that corner.
And you told Maxine.
Oh, yeah. Well, in fact, I did more than that. We stopped and filmed it. We filmed it and made it part of my video that I show in my classes.
What kind of emotions were you feeling then on this revisit?
Oh, it was very strange. It was very strange. But it was also kind of neat that I was not having to worry about being shot at and that my wife was with me instead of, you know, I wasn't carrying a gun. That was kind of nice.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So I just don't ever remember I don't remember making a big deal out of those incidents. I don't remember thinking that they were ever going to get us, because they didn't in my tour.
Right.
And I say that having been ambushed on an operation by the NVA and taken casualties, both us and them, earlier in my tour.
Right.
But it was almost as if I know the NVA aren't going to set up an ambush on this highway to get us. I don't know why I knew that, but I just did. I mean, if it's not the NVA, then we're okay. Because these guys are amateurs.
Right.
Now, the question is, as a historian, was I thinking that at the time, or am I thinking that now, linking back on it? Most likely, it was reaction. It was just my gut feeling that I've been there 9 months, 10 months by the time I get to there, and I say they haven't gotten this yet. They're really that bad. Same thing with their mortar effectiveness.
Right.
When they mortar us probably once a week, we'd take incoming, and there were times when, and it was usually no more than 4 to 6 rounds. They didn't even do the 2 rounds and then adjust kind of stuff that effectively. We had a little damage inside the compound, but not much. None of us were ever wounded from mortar fire until the night of the big siege. And so we thought they were not good at that either.
They were basically letting you know, we're here.
We're here.
And we're not trying to, as far as you guys know, they were trying to kill you.
I think they were trying, but they were not trying real hard. They never said, hey, let's go out with a unit of 30 instead of 10.
Right.
Or let's take some more effective weapons. Or let's use some 120-millimeter rockets instead of these 60-millimeter mortars on our compound.
Right.
Again, that all came much later in my tour. Mm-hmm. In this beginning thing, I have always attributed it to, and this will be hopefully, you know, part of my next book. I believe that the 4th Division's presence, which, and they were there until October of 1971. Mm-hmm. So I believe that their presence was the reason that the NVA were not in the province, or at least were not in the district. I can't say, because the province goes all the way up. I believe the province included all the way up to Con Tum, north of Pleiku.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it included Plei Ni and Plei Chirang and places like that. So it may be that, that there were some other areas that weren't as pacified, but I felt like we were a pacified district and that all this was just harassment.
I'm almost picturing, okay, if we're the Viet Cong, for example, and we're like, all right, let's, you know, who's going to go out into the, what, five or six are you going to go out and shoot the mortars tonight? Okay, mm-hmm. Go out and firemen, hurry back so we can, you know, finish roasting something, I don't know, over the fire or build our families.
It's very likely. Or it may even been VC who were truly Montagnard villagers that I knew. That they would see us come into the villages at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and do our medical thing. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of outbreaks of spinal meningitis, and so we would go in and we would inoculate people, and we would give food to the kids and or candy to the kids, and, you know, stuff like that. We'd do those little incident things, mm-hmm. and then it may be that for whatever reasons, that would be the night that they would hit us to let us know that, yeah, you're here and so are we. I don't know.
It's very interesting. What are the strengths that the NVA possessed?
The NVA? Well, I had two major contacts with the NVA. Mm-hmm. One in October of 1970. And then the other one in March 15th and 16th, and for the following week, at the Siege of Funyan in 1971. So, the first contact that I had with the NVA, October 7th, 1970, was we went out on it. The plan was that we had some intelligence that indicated that about probably 12 kilometers to the east of our compound, mm-hmm. there was a sighting of an NVA small unit.
By a FAC or?
No, it was by some intelligence from a village, from someone that had been in what was. It wasn't really a free fire zone, but it was where people weren't supposed to be. We had moved a village that was about 20 clicks in. We had moved that village to the highway starting in about August. And a lot of the people wouldn't stay, and they were going back. And so we had to be careful about declaring that a free fire zone. It really wasn't. These were Montagnards.
Right.
And so we got some intelligence that a small unit, and that could have been a scout team or a platoon size-wise, of NVA had been seen. And that was the first time. I'd only been there since August, but up until, I was there in July. And in July and August, we had been out on operations trying to find the NVA with our rough bus. And we had not found any. It appeared to us that the NVA had left the district. So this was the first time we had intelligence that indicated that that the NVA were back, if you will. And it was October, and it was about the time that the 4th Division were leaving for good from Pleiku. They had a big compound, 15,000 strengths. So they were gone. So I went up in a headhunter and surveyed the area and laid out this plan.
Did you see them?
No. Okay. No, didn't see anything on the opera. But we said, okay, let's go ahead and operate and conduct an operation tomorrow.
The purpose of which was to make contact.
To make contact, yes. To make contact. So we went out with a unit of... let's see. We took a unit of probably, I'm going to say, 35 RFPF. Mm-hmm. And these were probably PF, more popular forces than regional forces in that sense. And I'm a little hazy in my memory of the way the organization worked in Funyan. I know how it worked, supposed to work. In terms of the country, but in our district it was a little different. So, but I believe thinking back to the way we were dressed and everything, they were in seal pots and, you know, traditional army uniforms. My interpreter, my RTO, and one of my platoon sergeants, or one of my ranking platoon sergeants, would have been an E6. And then we took with us also two Americans that were part of an infantry platoon that were attached to the engineering battalion that was responsible for the for the construction of and the repaving and the keeping clear Highway 14.
Okay, and why? What was the purpose of having them there?
They were just good guys. They were Americans, and they were really good infantry soldiers and a little bit crazy. We became friends with this platoon of guys because these guys, they were a platoon of about, it wasn't a TOE platoon, it was called a platoon. It was probably 18 to 20 Americans, most of whom had a lot of combat experience in Vietnam. They were on their second, third tours. They were assigned to protect the vehicles when they were on the highway, but because sometimes they didn't have enough to do, they hang out at our compound.
Okay.
And they were just good guys, and they, like I say, in the somewhat crazy in the sense of they loved to go out on operations. They lived to fight.
And you said, hey guys, we're going to go out tonight.
Absolutely.
After NBA.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that I even had to say it that way. It was sort of like, because they were probably around when they heard that I was taking the operation out, I was going to be the ranking officer, they volunteered. And so they went out with us. So that was the unit. So there was probably 35 of us. We had a pre-planned artillery, laid it out. This was my first operation where I was sort of in charge.
Right.
I think I was on other operations before that, but this was the first one that I felt like I was in charge. I was a ranking officer. It was also at a time when I was the mobile advisory team leader. The leader had left, and they had not replaced him with it, because the TOE on mobile advisory teams was a captain and a first lieutenant. Right. I had just been promoted to first lieutenant, and there was no captain around, so I was the team leader.
Okay.
For about 6 weeks until they brought in a captain over me. So we were out on this operation, and and I remember the sound as if it were, you know, yesterday, a click. That's how close they were. The click, the firing of the B-40 rocket. It has a click sound to it. And then a whoosh. And a B-40 rocket that I'm sure was aimed at me, because I was in the center of the formation along with my RTO. It was either aimed at me or the RTO with the whip antenna coming up.
Is this nighttime or daytime?
Daytime. It was 1,400 hours, I'm going to say. In fact, I think it was exactly 1,400, because we always used to comment that in our earlier experiences, that when we had enemy contact out, it never happened between 12 and 1,400 hours. Never.
Like, not very siesta. Much time here.
Siesta. Absolute siesta. Viet Cong and our guys always had, respected each other's downtime.
Interesting.
And at about, so I think we probably had stopped for lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And we're back up. Oh, now that's a little not clear in my mind as to whether it happened. Happened, but the time, it definitely was 1,400 hours, because I remember writing the after-action report.
Okay.
And I remember hearing the sound, and then I remember no explosion. The B-40, the RPG, hit a tree about 3 feet from my head and fell to the ground.
Oh, my.
Did not explode.
So, at that moment, what are you thinking? Like, oh my God, I'm so lucky, or oh my God, they're watching us.
No, none of that. We're in an ambush.
Just immediately.
Absolutely. And then the small arms fire. Nobody was hit. And then we returned fire. And we laid down a lot of steel.
What did you do? Just hit the ground?
Hit the ground exactly where we were. And then we start firing. And then their firing stopped. And we heard screams and moans. And we pursued them, and we had wounded an NVA officer. I don't know. I believe the equivalent of a first lieutenant. I'm trying to think now. Tungui, as I recall,
which means.
First lieutenant.
Okay.
Second lieutenant is Chewy, and first lieutenant is Trum.
Okay.
And he was down, and he had been wounded, shot in the abdomen, and his intestines were out. And that's the first time that I had seen that in a living person. I'd seen it in dead people, dead. VC, but I'd never seen it in someone that was still alive.
Was he in uniform?
He was in uniform. He was in a nice uniform, a clean uniform. And he was not even in shock.
Really?
I remember his skin color staying dark, staying brown. And the reason that that's so clear in my mind, part of the reason that's so clear in my mind is that I wrote about it a little bit in my dissertation and putting it together with some things that I had done in the past. But the thing that was most striking to me is the color differential between his intestines and his hands, which were very brown.
And the intestines were what color?
White.
They were white. Was he bleeding profusely? Or?
No. I remember the stomach wound or the abdomen wound out. I got on the horn immediately, and I called some of the pre-planned artillery in, and then I called in gunships, Cobra gunships. I'd never done that.
Were you?
On their egress route.
Yes.
And
had you been looking forward to that moment where you call in some?
Oh, I don't know that I'd been looking forward to it, but this was the real deal. This was the first time. Like I said, I'd been ambushed, I'd been mortared. We'd even been in my very first contact when I earned my CIB. I'd been fired at and VC, and I knew that a round had just missed my head because I picked up the AK-47 round from that had hit the bamboo behind my head. In fact, I still have it. I haven't made it. It's made into a ring now. And so I had been, I'd been close and all that kind of stuff. But this time, I was now having to do something else. It was like there was something to do. We had been hit by, now, and this is obviously NVA.
Right.
So if he's NVA, then he's not alone. Why are they there? Scout team, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I also don't ever remember thinking, my goodness, there could be 150 of them out there, and this is the lead unit. Maybe in the general vicinity. That's why we called in the gunships, because the artillery wouldn't know. But if you call in gunships, they'd be able to see. I also called in, and the thing that I think I'm as, proud of, is I called in a medevac for the wounded NVA officer. We knew he was an officer because of his rank, his insignia, and he was carrying a pistol, a cigarette lighter, which I have, and a pistol scabbard, which I also have, or holster. And so we pursued. Now, we didn't pursue very far. We pretty much stayed on this guy. We set up our, perimeter, and I stayed with him.
His eyes were open, was he trying to communicate with him?
I got my interpreter over, and we tried to communicate, and he wasn't saying much. And I remember my biggest concern being his safety, his making sure he made it. In fact, this is going to sound strange, but my, and I have written about this. The guys from the engineering platoon, Pierce, he carried a special forces type knife. And I don't remember exactly the name for that, but it was a special kind of, it almost looked like a bowie knife. Mm-hmm. But it had a lot of etchings on it, so you could, you know, break wire with it. It's a survival knife. I think the pilots carried them too. But he had one that he bought on the black market somewhere, I guess. And I remember him reaching over, and I knew these guys were tough guys because they had shown me pictures of enemy contact that they had, and they had shown me things that bothered me even, that them in poses with within dead NVA or VC, I don't recall exactly.
What kind
in
of poses?
These pictures?
What kind of poses?
As if the dead were deer, posing with them as you would pose in a magazine, but holding the ears as if it was the deer there.
Okay.
So I knew these were some kind of crazy guys.
Yeah.
Loved having them with me on operations because I knew they were combat tested.
Of course.
And I wasn't in this kind of action. I was, you know, not up to that point. And I remember him reaching over and pulling that knife out. And I yelled at him. And I said, "Hey, I'm not Lieutenant Cowley." And I remember that because he repeated it to me later that night when we were drinking beer. And he said, "No, LT, I'm not." He said, "I want to cut some gauze." And with the other hand, he had taken out a package of gauze. And he took the knife and he cut the gauze and we bandaged the guy up.
Wow.
Did a great job with it.
Wow.
Saved his life. No question. Called in a medevac, put the guy on the medevac. And he was taken back to our district headquarters for interrogation.
Would you ask your interpreter to come over? What were the first questions you asked this officer?
How many more of them are you there? How many of you are there? And we didn't get an answer. But by that time, the artillery was raining in. Because the artillery, like I say, that's easy to bring in.
Yes.
And then I called off the artillery and I asked her, and now it's a little bit hazy in my mind as to whether he then said there's 100 of us. I don't think he did. But there, whatever his answer was, it gave me enough cause for concern that, or for opportunity, probably for opportunity more than concern.
Mm-hmm.
That we could effect body count.
Right.
And that the best way to do that is with Cobras. So I knew the Cobras would probably accompany the medevac anyway. So it wasn't like I was doing something that was, I don't know whether I was ever concerned about this, but thinking back on it now was, why would I bring in Cobra gunships if I've already got one guy down in a small unit or something? But I think I was probably rationalizing that the Cobras would come in with the medevac anyway.
Right.
And so therefore, we might as well use them.
Mm-hmm.
So, brought the medevac in, put the guy on it. None of us were wounded, nobody was hurt at all. And so we put him on the medevac, got him out, brought in the Cobras, blew up, lit up everything in the general area. And then walked back to our company. So this is 12 clicks out. And so we went back. And I remember going back, it's pretty vivid in my mind, because we had to cross a lot of rice paddies. We had to, and there's always this issue, and you read about it all the time, American units, you know, whether you walk the dikes or whether you walk in the... And I remember knowing all that because I studied it, you know. I know we were not supposed to walk the dikes. But I also remember wanting to get back because now we had this contact. See, we went out on that enemy, on that contact. I mean, we went out on that operation. And I don't remember that I thought for sure because that we'd make enemy contact. I think it was a surprise to us. So now it's like probably 1,600 hours. And we need to get back. And if we have another contact on the way back, then it's going to be even later, and then you're going to get into dark and all that stuff. And I remember wanting to get back quick. So I remember crossing these rice paddies and walking the dikes and knowing that that was not smart. That is, you know, you're exposed, you're up. But I didn't want to get down in that damn, in the water. Yeah. And it was not planned that we go back. It must not have been planned that we go back that way. We must have been planning on going a different route because we did go back a different route. And I think that maybe that was planned. Maybe it was a circular plan that way. But I do remember the incident just like it was yesterday. And we went and we got back in by dark, before dark, because they were interrogating the NVA officer.
He was. You saw him again. He was back.
I didn't go see him. I didn't want to. The interrogation responsibilities in our unit. We had an S2. We had an intelligence officer, a captain, Daiwi. And he and one of the men, another man on the district team, an NCO, were. Part of an intelligence unit that we didn't really have much to do with. They didn't go out on operations with us. They did all the interrogations and everything. They were the ones that monitored the Phoenix program in our area and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I remember coming back and they were interrogating him in another room.
Could you hear it?
Yeah. All I asked was, is he going to make it? I remember asking that, and they said, yes. I said, is he giving us anything we can use? And they said, yes. And that's all I found out.
What did you hear?
I didn't hear screaming. I heard yelling. I heard yelling in Vietnamese from our interpreters and from him.
Okay.
I assume him. And this was a big deal. I mean, this was a big deal. The district chief was there. The major, our major was there. Everybody but those of us who had caused it to happen, and we were drinking beer.
And you essentially captured an NVA officer.
Yeah.
Huge. Your first NVA contact.
Yes.
And it's your operation.
Yes.
It's your first operation you're in charge.
Yes.
How did you feel?
I felt good. I felt real good. I felt good for a variety of reasons. I felt good because, number one, this guy was alive, and my guys had kept him alive, and our actions in the medevac had kept him alive. I remember feeling a lot of respect for this guy. I don't remember hating him. I don't remember hating him as the enemy the way you hated that I hated the Viet Cong, as much so that were firing at me from the... you know, from the road every day.
Would you have medevaced the VC if you had...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think I would have. But I don't... Everything just happened very quickly, and no one argued. Nobody said, ALT, what do we want to waste a medevac on? No, nothing like that. It was just automatic. It was getting back to the... Well, the medevac. Now, this is another thing. We medevaced him. And I don't know that I knew where he would end up. I don't know that I even made that decision.
So your medevac was more a normal kind of procedure,
yes.
Humanitarian, more yeah. Versus, okay, this guy's an intelligence coup for us. Or was it a combination?
I don't know that I made that decision. I don't know why the medevac took him back to the district compound instead of play coup to the hospital. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, he obviously got medical treatment back at your compound.
Yeah. Oh yeah, because we had a medic there, and we had a medic on our op. Well, wait a minute. We didn't have a medic on the operation. We did our own on him.
Right.
But we all knew what to do. But back there, we had a medic, so they would have attended to him there before they and then I think the next stop would have been the play coup hospital. But it bothers me a little bit today that I don't know what else happened to him. I don't mean that I don't know where he is today. That would be, but it bothers me that I don't know and don't. Apparently didn't inquire about what happened to him then.
Maybe you were internally shaken up by the whole experience. Just overwhelmed, maybe.
Well, I don't... Just sort of routine. It was just sort of like, this is what we do, and so therefore the next day we did something else. Although there was nothing ever quite that significant that happened.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
I and my RTO and my sergeant were all three given the Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry with bronze palm for the action. And I'm not sure about the two Americans from the... I don't think they were awarded anything because they weren't supposed to be there. They didn't
Right.
want their superiors to know that they weren't drinking beer with us over at the compound that day. I think that's what happened.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, if you don't mind indulging me, when you come to him and he's there and you are you're thinking, okay, I'm gonna try to patch the guy up. I'm gonna do the medevac. I mean, you're thinking this. You call the interpreter over. You're trying to find out how many more are out there.
Right.
Do you try to communicate personally to him? Do you say, besides, how many more are there of you? After you get that answer, and after you have the artillery coming in, and after you've got the covers, I guess, coming in, and the medevac, what do you do? Do you move away from him?
No, I stayed right there.
Stayed beside him? Were you kind of kneeling there?
Well, we had a perimeter, and in the way it works, you set up your perimeter, and then you set up a CP within it. And the CP was essentially me, my RTO, and the wounded guy.
Right. And so you're on the radio, you're doing this stuff, and the interpreter, I guess, is there as well.
Yeah.
South Vietnamese.
Monsignor.
He's a Monsignor. Did the Monsignor show any hostility toward the soldier?
Yes. Yeah, I do recall that. I recall that the Monsignor interpreter, and we would have had other Monsignors in the unit, I'm sure, but my Monsignor interpreter, who I was very close to, was really screaming at him, and I, you were asking, did I try to communicate? I didn't try to communicate directly in terms of using my Vietnamese. My English came out, and as I would talk, he would interpret for me. As I would ask the questions.
Okay.
But in my mind, at this moment, is not. I wish it were clearer. All the things that I wanted to know. And I don't recall, and because it's not fresh in my mind, and other things are, I'm not sure that I believed that at that moment, other than finding out how big a unit they were, I'm not sure I was overly concerned about the bigger picture.
Right.
I figured that would be up to somebody else that we had our hands full of.
Yeah, I can't imagine you kind of putting all this into some big picture when you're sitting there right in the middle. You've just been ambushed, back. Here's an officer severely wounded in front of you, and you're trying to figure out, you're protecting your men, you're trying to carry out your mission.
Right.
Probably not thinking.
No, I wasn't thinking globally or a bigger impact or anything else. I figured there's other people who can deal with that.
What did you do with the guy's intestines? I mean, do you just kind of push them back in and crack the gauze?
Yeah. I don't think we pushed them back in. He was trying to cover them with his fingers. And I always wondered whether he was trying to hide the wound from us, mm-hmm. or if it's a natural instinct to do that.
To hold them in.
Yeah. I remember we pulled his hands back, but then we bandaged him. We did the bandage around the back kind of thing so that they would be held in. Now I'm sure we put something over the top of the gauze also, some kind of an elastic bandage. I don't remember that part too much.
Do you think he was surprised, or did he act surprised that you were not going to kill him and that you were going to medevac him? You were trying to take care of him.
I don't know the answer to that. I'm guessing that he was surprised at the care that we took with him. But that had an indelible impact on me. And I, as part of my dissertation, as part of my whole attitude towards the war and everything about it, I'm always amazed when I hear men from American units that somehow or other, and this is October of 70, and as you know, then April, May of 71, when the Winter Soldier investigations all start and everything. And I would read and hear about people in American units that supposedly took no prisoners, and how they, you know, supposedly would brag about killing NVA soldiers. And I never understood why you would do that, because militarily that is the dumbest thing you could ever do. There were very few times in Vietnam when American units could not take prisoners logistically. You know, you hear about you're on some kind of march, and you know, the World War II kind of thing, and if you took the prisoners, then it would slow you down and stuff, and sometimes those things happen. But I never understood in Vietnam, that was very seldom the case, mm-hmm. and it was also a case in Vietnam where medevacs were always available.
Right.
So you could always take care, virtually always take care of enemy soldiers. And it makes no military sense whatsoever to execute a prisoner of war. Because they've got so much intelligence. They're what you're out there. The fact that you have just accomplished that, you can save lives by getting information from these guys. Now, I can't speak to the interrogation techniques and methods and stuff like that. That's not my area. But it made no military sense. And that, I always doubted why any officer would allow that to happen, because it makes no sense. You want to know what he knows.
Right.
And so to say, oh, we executed all of our... That makes no sense. So I always doubted it. I always wonder about guys that talk like that.
I've heard it in my interviews.
I know, I'm sure you have. And it makes no sense. As an officer, well, maybe as an enlisted man, if you're doing it, you should not be ever doing it at the direction of somebody who has a mission. And the mission is, you know, you have a mission, you also have a mission to keep your guys alive, and you want to know what this guy knows. So, now in this case, I thought we had a prize, and we did. We had a junior officer. Mm-hmm. But it was an important thing that happened in my tour, and I'll never forget it. I mean, it was really quite a deal, and yet it was all in an afternoon's work. It wasn't like we did it after a 2 week operation.
2 and 5 in the afternoon.
Absolutely, we went out about 9 that morning, so we had gone out quite a ways. In fact, my guess is, now that making it through here and talking about it, my guess is that when the firefight happened, of what it was, and the incident happened, we probably were a lot closer to the compound than than I had thought at the time. And I think maybe we took a shortcut back in.
You were on your way back in.
Yeah. We got back, you know, within, I think we were back by, I know this, that when I called back in, as we usually did when we were out, we said, hey, make sure Jim holds some chow for us. I remember being hungry. But we felt good that night. We felt like we had really accomplished something.
Did you write Maxine? Tell her about it.
I don't know whether I did or not. I think I probably did in some veiled fashion. But I remember getting my CIB so early in my tour, but I remember feeling like I'd really earned it. I wasn't quite sure about the Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry. There's a memory there that says that we were so proud of what we had done, but that our commanding officer didn't think it was any big deal, and none of us got American awards, and it was the Vietnamese who gave us the award.
Why in the world would your commanding officer not think that was a big deal?
Because he wasn't there.
He wasn't out on the operation with you. So was it a jealousy thing?
Yes.
Did you all realize that?
Yes. It was part of the problem with the command structure.
In Vietnam or with your...
No, I think in Vietnam, based on my research, but my own personal experience was that there were certain people like that had trouble giving awards to lower ranking people if they weren't involved themselves. And I remember when the Vietnamese decided to give us the Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry.
Who made that decision?
The district chief. He was very impressed. The district chief, the Vietnamese
who
district
was
chief.
There that night in the interior, doing the interrogation.
Yes.
Was it like, okay, the next day I'm going to...
It was about 3 weeks later, and they had this big ceremony over in Funyan Village on the volleyball court. The volleyball was a big deal in the village. The RFPF guys played volleyball time, and we would play against them and stuff. We would just get our ass kicked all the time. They were
really
so much better than any of us.
I want to have you take some time and describe the village and what you all did there, what you saw, what it smelled like, all of that.
Sure.
And we can do that in a bit going forward.
But they had this very nice ceremony on the volleyball court. I mean literally on the volleyball court, in that we were playing volleyball.
Right.
And then they came over, and I knew it was going to happen, but we didn't dress for it or anything, and they said, we're going to have the ceremony to award, and it was me and my RTO and my sergeant. And they read this really nice thing and had a certificate, you know, just like we have in our country with the ribbons showing, and they read this, of course, all in Vietnamese, and then they pinned these very nice awards on us, which I still have.
That's really neat. Did the people clap?
Yes, yes.
The villagers kind of came.
Yes, the villagers all came around and clapped. Not very many. Well, I can't remember whether the major was there or not.
I was going to ask you that.
I don't remember. It was the only time in our entire, my year there, that the Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry was awarded to any soldiers for valor. I think maybe the major, the district advisor, got the Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry, kind of like in American units, you could be awarded the Bronze Star for service. Or you could be awarded a Bronze Star for valor. And, of course, Silver Stars and above are for valor anyway. But the Bronze Star, the Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry with bronze palm, was a valor award, not a service award. It was for an incident. And I don't believe anyone else got that. that during my tour. Even during the Siege of Hunan, none of us were awarded that. We were awarded American medals for that particular incident, or for that particular siege. But the Vietnamese honor was something special because they saw it as valuable. And we were with their unit. Maybe there was even some kind of a, it might be a situation where because we were on a Vietnamese operation and we were the advisors, that we were not eligible for American awards. I don't know that to be the case. But if that were an option for our particular major, he would have used it, in my opinion, because he was very jealous of our actions.
He would have used it to not be there he
would have used it to make sure we... Because he wasn't there, and he was never there. I mean, he didn't go out on operation. Which probably isn't wrong. I'm not suggesting that it necessarily was. Mm-hmm. But... I don't know. There was just a strange feeling about that, but we were pretty proud. It was a good day. It was a good day in the life of a junior officer.
Sure, it sounds like it. Let me come back to the question: did you write Maxine and tell her about this incident? I mean, is it in your letters, or is this something?
I don't know the answer to that.
This is special.
Yeah, and I wrote a lot more than in some of the review of letters that we're going through right now. I wrote a lot more things down than I remembered writing. I sort of had a memory of sanitizing everything, and I now find that I didn't sanitize as much as I thought. Mm-hmm. In the case of one of the of another incident. So I assume that I probably did. I know we talked about it when we went on R&R in January. I told her all about it. I can remember having that discussion. And I remember telling her about the B-40 not going off. And it wasn't the first time. I mean, I'd had it happen on a Jeep.
Bounced off your windshield.
Yeah, yeah. And this one bounced off a tree. That's
amazing.
Or it just, well, it is, except that I think... In talking with other soldiers and their experiences with the B-40 rocket launcher, I don't know if it's a matter, I don't know, and probably I knew it at the time, maybe one of my ordnance guys would have figured it out, but it's possible that it was a malfunction of the firing mechanism of the B-40 rocket launcher rather than with the RPG itself.
Right, that there was a faulty launch, basically.
When the firing pin came forward, it didn't connect. And I think what happens now, this is in VA, so they should have had a better handle on mm-hmm. their resources, their assets, than would have been the VC. But you don't know how long those guys have been out. They may have been 2-3 weeks out, and it may have gotten wet. You know, the rocket may have gotten wet, but I think it was more a function of the launcher itself. So we captured the rocket launcher, of course, captured all these things. Captured the rocket launcher. I kept that in my hooch, and there I have pictures of that on my wall in the in my video. I put the B-40 rocket launcher on my gun. I had a big gun rack, and I had a SKS on there, and I had this B-40, and I had an AK-47, and all these things. But the pistol that he carried.
Did you disarm him pretty quickly?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't remember doing it myself. I think someone else did. I took and will give to the archives here as an artifact the pistol, the scabbard, the holster, and the belt, the gun belt that was attached to, and the cigarette lighter. Those were the souvenir relics that I took and brought home.
When did you take them off of him? Was it
right then? I think as we were bandaging him up, we took his belt off.
And his
belt
had his, just,
yeah, did all that stuff. And I remember, but I remember the pistol. I gave the pistol to one of these engineer platoon guys.
One of the guys who weren't supposed to be there, but
yeah.
When did you give it to him? later, or was it that night?
I don't know the answer to that, but I remember specifically thinking, you take this. And I don't know why exactly. There must have been some feeling on my part that these guys did a good job, because maybe they were more the gun collectors and stuff. You could take those home. You had to file for them, and it was a really involved thing, as you could take SKS home. I didn't bring any weapons home. As I recall, it was a hassle to bring them home. You had to do a lot of paperwork, and there were rumors that when you got to Travis Air Force Base, you had to stay an extra day or two to clear them, and I didn't want to stay any extra. I wanted to go home. I don't know if that's true, but I didn't bring anything like that home. I did bring some other artifacts home. But I remember thinking that one of those guys should have it, and they may have even carried it for the rest of the tour, and they were still around at the end of the tour. They participated in the siege of Funia, so but I don't really recall that. But in terms of my wife, I think we talked about it a lot, and I do remember the incident.
You described it quite vividly today. Tell me about the lasting effect of this incident. You've mentioned it a couple of times, that it has stayed with you. I mean, I can see for obvious reasons why, but beyond that, what?
Well, I think it sort of, this was October, so I knew I had a long time to go. I was going to be there until May 28th was my DROS date. And I remember thinking that this is what we're supposed to do. I do remember that. I remember that this, and I don't ever remember thinking, gee whiz, I don't want to ever do this again. And we did do it again. We never had contact like that. We were never ambushed again. We went out a lot of operations. Mm-hmm. So we were successful. I also don't remember having feeling at the time that, well, the next one might get me or anything like that. I don't ever remember thinking, gee, I don't want to do this again. In fact, maybe just the opposite. Maybe it gave me a false feeling of security, as damn, we're good. Mm-hmm. The guys did good, both the Americans and the RFPN did a good job.
You were proud.
I was real proud. And I was proud of the fact that we gathered intelligence. I was proud of the fact that we kept the guy alive. Everything worked. Pardon?
You didn't lose anyone?
Didn't lose anyone. It was almost like this is the way it's supposed to happen. Mm-hmm. And so I think I, in some maybe perverse sort of way, I looked forward to doing it again, the next operation. I was proud of the fact that we had stopped the ambush. I was proud of the fact that we had kept him alive. I didn't know about any other deaths. We did, you know, we pursued to see. We saw a lot of blood trails, but we don't, you know. And something that would be interesting, and this is, you'll appreciate this as a historian, when I was in Washington, D.C., doing my research for my dissertation, the archivist there, Rich Boylan, who is kind of a friend of this place, mm-hmm. He took my wife and I on a tour of the archives in the back rooms, which I guess is unusual, but anyway, it was nice. And he said, "What unit were you in?" And I told him, "Matt team or Province Team 36, Mobile Advisory Team 38, like who knows stuff." And he walked us into this archive, and he pointed up, and he said, "There is all the Mobile Advisory Team 38 things from 1967, I believe, is when they first started, all the way to 1972. Year after action reports are right
there."
Wow. So, want me to pull them? And I said, "No." I said, "If I get into that now, I'll never do what I'm supposed to do on this trip." I said, "Someday I'm going to get in there and relive these incidents, but I'm not prepared to do it right now, so I didn't. So in hopefully, and if I write book two, it's going to be about this whole thing and the Siege of Funan and everything, and I will get into that and read them in my after, because I'm sure I wrote the after action report.
Yeah.
Be interesting to see if it's as accurate as I'm remembering
it. You're doing the best you can, obviously.
Yeah.
You mentioned you had some regret about this gentleman, this officer. And you didn't really mention specifically what that was about, or you weren't sure what that was about.
Well, he's an officer. I hope that he made it. I hope that he was put into a POW camp, or I hope that he became a Chuvoy. He was an officer. He was a junior officer, just like me.
He was like you.
But my guess is he had fought, been in the Army a lot longer than I had. I don't recall that I saw his wallet or his identification. I mean, I may have, but I don't recall that I did. And I would like to know, in some way, that he made it, that we somehow kept him alive. But I don't know that to be the case. But I still to this day I have a lot of respect for the NVA soldiers, because I think they were very good soldiers, and I think this guy was probably part of the scout team that was out there. He was probably the platoon leader of the scout team, and. And, you know, he was probably a long ways from home. And so I hope that he made it, and that their army won, you know, ultimately. And who knows what he... I assume he probably never went back to his unit.
Probably
not. He was a POW. And who knows, the South Vietnamese POW camps were pretty rough. So he may not have made it. But he was alive. We saved his life after trying to take it. Mm-hmm. And hopefully we got some intelligence from him. Although, the interesting thing is, too, that's the only contact I ever had with the NVA from October. Or to my knowledge, in my memory, none of us ever had another contact with the NVA until March of 1971, almost 6 months later. So I don't know for sure what we learned, but maybe we learned that they're not there, and that how this scout team was kind of there... I don't know.
I would think that the intelligence officers, the people who were interrogating him, tried to ascertain his identification.
Yes.
And it's probably in some report somewhere.
That's what I'm thinking. And it bothers me a little bit that I don't know more about what we found out on the intelligence. It's almost as if, because I'm assuming that someone told me something and I have forgotten it. So it's almost as if I was the infantry, I did my job, now you guys do yours and we'll go do something else. And why wasn't my curiosity greater to have wanted to know the big picture on what we did?
How old were you then?
25.
You've already said you're not thinking that big picture. You know,
no.
You're 25 years old. You're a junior officer. You've done an excellent job out on an operation. You're back. You're alive. Everybody's good. You're drinking beer with your buddies, and like you said, it seems like when you describe that incident to me, just as an observer, it seemed like here you were. You've done your job, and you guys were rewarding yourself with some beer and some laughs and some conversation. Not laughing about you know, hit the guy or anything, but then you know that you've passed him to the next stage of the experience.
Yeah, I guess my curiosity is more of a recent thing, perhaps, because I don't ever remember thinking too much about it, even in the last few years. I mean, in the last few years, I thought about it a lot, but in the ensuing years between when I came home and about 6 years ago, I don't remember, other than the incidents fresh in my mind, but the outcome of it is not. It was never a curiosity for me that I would pursue it. So I may someday, but it was quite a day.
Sounds like it. How old was this guy, do you think?
I'm going to guess late teens, early 20s. Mm-hmm. I mean, he looked, I can still see his face so clearly. I think he, and the amazing thing is that I don't remember him being in great anguish.
You almost describe him as serene, calm.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I'm trying to think whether I don't know whether we use morphine. We all carried the little small breakable morphine pieces that you break and then you jam them into your thigh.
Right.
We may have done that. I didn't, but one of my men may have done that, and that may have. But even in the when we first got to him, when we first signed down, I don't remember him particularly. It was almost like he had not a grin, but sort of a grin on his face. That's strange, but it's the only time in my tour that we captured an enemy that my unit did. Oh, now and then we'd go into a village and the PSDF would have captured some guy the night before and that kind of stuff. But the only time I was ever involved myself. Mm-hmm. And it did form a lasting impression. And like I say, to this day, I don't understand when Vietnam veterans try to make the case, whether it's true or not, and I hope it's not, that there were all these executions of prisoners, we didn't have time for it and stuff like that. And I'm thinking, man, that's what you're out there for, is find out stuff. That's part of the operation.
Right.
And I can't imagine any officer allowing that to happen. So I usually discount it. And I'm sure, like you say, you've talked to veterans that will admit to that kind of stuff.
It's rare.
Well, I'm glad to know it's rare.
Because
it makes no military sense at all.
Was there a reaction on this guy's face when the other guy, Pierce, I guess, just pulled out his knife?
I don't recall that there was. I think it was just an overreaction on my part. And I should have known better than to yell like that, because I knew Pierce, but I was worried that maybe that I didn't know him real well. If it had happened 6 months later, after I really got to know these guys, I would have never said it, because I knew the kind of guys they were. They were warriors, and I think the picture taking and stuff of the bodies and stuff was just their way of, it was just what they did. But I don't consider that, I've never considered that kind of activity to be of the same atrocity kind of thing. The defamation of bodies is bad and all that stuff within our culture. But it's not a big deal with me. I don't put it in the same category as taking the life of somebody that's down. And so I did overreact. I remember using Callie's name, because see, that was Callie was March of 68, but we didn't know about it until October of 69.
It's fresh, right?
And
there.
It's fresh, and we had been told about it in OCS. We had been talked about in our training when I went Special Forces before Bragg thing. We talked about all of that, and it was really fresh in my mind. And so I didn't want that to happen. And I just saw that knife come out, and I thought, whoa,
here we go.
And I think it was also a matter of, this is weird to think, but I think it was also a matter of, this guy was just doing his job. This NVA soldier was doing what we're doing. We're out hunting him, he's hunting us. And,
right.
And he got the first shot in, and we've got the second shot in. So it's over. It's over for him.
Right.
Doesn't have to be any more over than that. It's over for him, and we've got him. We'll see what he knows. But I don't remember anger. don't remember being mad at him at all.
Did that surprise you at the time?
I don't know. Even to this day, I don't think of war that way. I don't even remember when things got really rough later on that in any combat situation I ever felt any hatred. I almost remember thinking, I wish I did.
Really?
Yeah, it would be easier.
You could see the humanity and what was happening.
I could see what they are being asked to do. It's exactly what my country was asking me to do. I had great respect for them as soldiers. Less so for the VC, like I say, because I think they were a little cheating just a little bit by hiding and shooting at night, and I'm sure the NVA did that too, mm-hmm. but it was different with the NVA. Yeah, it was different with them. They were a long ways from home. These VC guys, they got to live in the village at night and pretend there was somebody else. Mm-hmm. Safer deal. These NVA boys, they had come down from the north. And they maybe had been there a long time. And their country was saying, let's keep the Americans out. And they were dedicated to do it.
Mm-hmm. Maybe his grin or his smile that you kind of remember something seeing that. Maybe he was acknowledging...
So for me. I've thought about that.
War stone.
Exactly. $1 million wound. If he was confident that he wasn't going to die, and I don't know whether not ever having been wounded like that, I don't know whether you know that you have a life-threatening wound. And maybe even that maybe our reaction to him was such that he felt that he would be taken care of. Now, he may have changed his mind when we turned him over to the Vietnamese. I don't know.
Ron, tell me about the medevacs. We hear so much about them, their bravery, the fact they would come in really under almost any circumstances to take out American and allied wounded and even the enemy wounded.
Yes.
What was your impression there?
Well, on this case, they weren't in any danger, but what I know about them mostly is based on my experiences later in the siege of Hunan. They were absolutely terrific, not just the medevacs, but the resupply choppers and everything that brought stuff into us. They were great. And I'll tell you another interesting thing about the medevacs is... You've interviewed a lot of men, and you probably know more about this than I do, but I don't remember the medevacs being unarmed. Do they tell you that?
They usually have weapons with them.
Exactly.
They usually had a sidearm or something in the cockpit, sawed-off shotgun, something.
But they didn't. But see, my memory is that they had door guns. And that's against the Geneva Convention and all that kind of stuff with that great big old cross on the front. But I remember that at the Siege of Hunan, when they came in to medevac my good friend Ed out, I thought they had door gunners. I can't imagine coming in without a door gunner.
They did have door gunners. Not everyone did, but I think maybe circumstances and perhaps the pilot's own personal predilections said, hey, I want a door gunner.
Yes.
Going into a hot zone.
LZ and all this stuff. I mean, I know it's against the Geneva Convention, but so is shooting at a helicopter with a cross on it.
Yes, and perhaps I also know their experiences have been that it didn't matter. They had the cross on their
head.
They were completely shot at.
Right.
And not all of them all the time had the Cobra escorts.
Yeah. Well, and the reason, the only reason that, because I remember I was at an air show Angel Fire, and there were some Huey choppers there, and we were talking to this guy, and there was one guy there that was a Vietnam veteran. He says, of course, in Vietnam we didn't have the door gunners, and I didn't want to challenge him And I got to thinking later, man, the guys I knew did, and maybe it was just a function of being late in the war like that and not having American units around to protect them. I can even, maybe what they did was put the guns, take the guns off when they landed at the hospital in Baku. I mean, I'm sure nobody will admit to having been a door gunner on a medevac, but they had to have medics on there, right?
They did.
So the medics were really just sit in a chair?
They had a crew back there who would, I mean, had to get the person onto the, or the people onto the chopper.
Right.
Medically take care of them and provide for a safe exit.
Right.
Basically. Now, I've heard from dust-off pilots where they don't describe any kind of, you know, door gunners or anything. They come in, they get the wounded, and they go. Whether they're leaving out the fact that they might have had someone with an M16 standing there, you know, one guy's going to get the body on, or
yeah,
people on, the other guy's going to be laying down fire.
Yeah. Well, I guess I don't know either, but I sure, my memory is the, but yeah, they were some special kind of people, but all of those pilots were, my goodness, even a Cobra gunship with all of its armament, they were just so vulnerable. Once you're in, once you come, I mean, you're vulnerable to anti-aircraft weapons. You're mm-hmm. vulnerable to any M50 cals. Easy to take to come down with on a Cobra, and even the Huey, the troop transporters were. You know, they're just subjected to all that stuff. B-40s on the hot LZ, you can take one out so easily. And so I have a lot of respect for those guys. A lot of respect.
You could rely on them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, oh, my goodness, yes. I don't ever remember in the few times that I called in air support. And it was always, except for one incident, it was always Cobra gunships. I only called in F-4s once, and that was later in my tour. But the Cobras really, I don't ever remember them being late. I don't ever remember being frustrated because I couldn't get them in. They were always right there, 15 minutes from Baku. Boom. Had them on site.
That had to instill some kind of maybe an unconscious confidence.
Oh my goodness!
That you knew the dust off guys would be there. You knew the Cobras
yep.
would be there. You knew this. You knew that going
absolutely.
Out.
Absolutely. Oh, and what a sight to see them work!
What did it sound like? What did that day sound like? As you were describing, you know, you say you heard the click, mm-hmm. and then I think that's
small arms.
Yeah.
Then small arms, AKs. The higher pitch sound of an AK-47 than an M16 didn't last very long.
The AKs or the whole small arms?
Well, no, the AKs. Then we laid down a lot of fire. We were M16, and we put the and then the thump guns, M79. We got those out there, you know. And then ceasefire. I yelled ceasefire, and we didn't hear anything else except this great guy screaming. And some running. I mean, I heard not real loud, but we heard the exiting sounds of the soldiers, or the NVA soldiers. That's why we knew there was a bunch of them, but not a whole bunch, because they would have stayed and fought. That's the way I looked at it. This is a company size ambush. It's not over.
Right. They're set up.
Yes, somehow they know where they are. We don't know where we are. I mean, that was the other thing I remember is while I was down with this guy, kneeling down with him and everything, I remember pretty much knowing exactly where we are to call in that artillery. And that still amazes me to this day. I'm pretty good with directions and things like that, but I'm not necessarily a guy that will keep my nose in a map, even when I'm on the highway. So I don't recall how I had so much confidence to call in the artillery.
When you're walking back in, or I guess walking out, or walking anywhere, Are you thinking to yourself, okay, I just left these coordinates, now I'm entering these coordinates? Just left this.
No, I think what I'm thinking is, I know pretty much, you sort of rehearse the operation, and you do it, I used to do it by natural landmark streams and rises in the terrain, and you know, you have topo maps, so you know when you're going up, you know when you're coming down. But I remember being pretty sure where I was. First rounds were marker rounds, so that helps a little bit. And then, you know, fire for effect and bringing the rest of it in. So once the first, as long as the first round gets close to where you are. But calling in artillery, it was a special skill that I hadn't had a lot of experience with. And so, you know, adjusting and all that kind of stuff. I don't remember that we had to do a lot of adjusting. And it's also possible that my platoon sergeant may have done that. And in other words, my memory is not as vivid on that as to how that for sure. I do know that I called in the medevac and I called in the Cobras. So it may be that I wasn't adjusting the that I didn't call in the artillery. It may have been my guy that did it. Mm-hmm. Or even my RTO, they were really good. Rodriguez, he was good.
What do the Cobras sound like when they're coming in and laying down the fire?
Oh, boy, I tell you what, they just...
Are you down? I mean, are you covering your head? I mean, when artillery starts coming out, are you guys getting down?
First round. I could hear it coming in. And it wasn't, see, it wasn't that far away. We were probably 6 or 7 clicks away from Funyan, so it's not that far, and so the rounds came very quickly, and they were, I'm trying to think, I don't remember whether they were 105s or 155s that we used, most likely 105s because we were really close, but we had 155s there too. And but the Cobras, the thing that was always interesting to me is when they'd come in, they'd work, and they'd use they had 40 millimeter grenade launchers, essentially like you're firing from an M79. So you've got a delay, you've got a fire, you got a hit, and then you've got an explosion. And then they had they also had miniguns, and I don't remember the caliber. I assume they were 7.62 miniguns that would work the area also. Mm-hmm. But I remember that the really neat thing was when they'd come in and they'd light it up, and then they'd make those turns, you know, they'd come back around for that second pass, you know. They were really something. And then, of course, you're talking to them. You know, you need to talk as they're...
That's what they're
saying. Yeah, that's what they're sounding like. You got the things in your eye here, you know, and that's the sound that you're hearing on the other end. Mm-hmm. And you know, they would let you know that they didn't, whether they saw something or didn't see something. And I was always kind of cynical about, I thought once they're on site, they're seeing something, even if they're not,
right.
Because that's what they do, you know.
Right.
And I suppose that it's particularly neat when you're pretty confident that you have the that you're not going to get. You're not going to be in defense. You're going to truly be on offense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were most of the time. On that particular day, I think they were having a field. It was a lot of fun. Now, later on in my tour, when we talk about the siege, it won't be fun for them.
Yeah.
And they will really be in it. But that particular day, I think it was one of those perfect operations in the sense that you know, we did our job, they did their job, and there was not a lot of danger for them at that moment, nor was there a lot of danger for us once the scout team was out of there.
The sounds of battle then are I guess buried on the weaponry, obviously, in the distance from what's happening out there. But it's, I can only assume it's loud.
Yeah, but this one was so short that it wasn't. When we talk about the siege, it's really loud. Oh my goodness! You know, my hearing today is still affected by it, kind of thing. It was really bad. And I don't remember even in this case the smells of battle, because there was no death. There were no rotting corpses or any of that kind of stuff. And so I don't. That's not doesn't stick in my mind about that operation. The operation I just described to you is, like I say, the perfect operation. It's what you would hope all operations would be, but aren't. Everything went right. Mm-hmm. And so that's a good feeling. That's a good memory of having done everything that you could do. That's not what war mostly is. And so had I come home with only that memory, I would probably be much like some of those warriors who sat behind the desk in Saigon for their tours and have a positive memory of battle that they never took part in, but they can imagine that they did. Well, I really did take part in that, and everything worked perfectly. And that's not a healthy memory of war, because that's not what war is. And I would find out what war really is in a few months.
Why don't we wrap up for today?
Okay. Good.
Thanks, Ron.